this is Christopher Holmes, the fool at the zero point, and you're back. We're here once again for Zero Point Teachings on BBS Radio. Today I have as a guest James Moffat, who was with me last week, and I have a full program planned for the day. Just to begin, I'd like to make a couple of announcements. Firstly, if you are interested in the materials I'm presenting, I invite you to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. Or if you'd like to email me, you can email me at christopherholmes@rogers.com. The term zero point is taken from the writings of Madame Blavatsky, who in The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888, once wrote, "Material points without extension, zero points, are the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." In this radio teaching series, I'm trying to explain mystical and esoteric views of the origins of human consciousness and the nature of existence. Blavatsky's quote here suggests that all living beings have zero-point foundations or origins, so we ourselves would have such a zero-point center. In this series, I'm trying to explain and elaborate upon such possibilities and the type of higher dimensional physics and metaphysics that this involves. According to occultists, human beings have a most amazing mystical, magical nature. In a sense, we all have within us sparks of holiness, or divine sparks. Consider that as a point source of light established in higher dimensional space. So we all have this higher dimensional origin. And that element somehow is then embodied in different bodies. And so we come down into the physical world and we're embodied in the physical body. But we are not simply the body. I'm suggesting that human consciousness has its origins through this higher dimensional physics of the heart. That, in a sense, a human being has an I, an individual I, within the lotus of the heart, or the cave of Brahman. That we all have some monadic essence within the heart. And that in order to understand ourselves from a mystical point of view, we have to understand the self within the heart. The whole of Western psychology and philosophy and science for the past century has dismissed the study of human beings as having a spirit or soul, and it has been assumed that human consciousness is simply produced by the brain in the head. That I call the head doctrine, to contrast with the heart doctrine of spiritual teachings. Within the heart doctrine, this jiva atma, or individual self, or monad, is associated with the higher dimensional nature of the human heart. Madame Blavatsky, in explaining the creation of universes, states, "The suns expand and contract through their own hearts." So we similarly expand and contract through our own hearts, through within our life and through death and through different dimensions. So this series of radio programs on Zero Point Teachings, I'm trying to elaborate as clearly as I can this complex alternative model of the nature of human existence. And it's not an easy task to convey the essence of what I'm teaching, but if you bear with me over time, then more and more you can understand and grasp some of these zero-point concepts. Most importantly, I'm encouraging people as you listen to the shows to work on yourself, striving towards your own self-remembering and making an effort to wake up at different times in your days and weeks and life to try to be more fully conscious of yourself within space and to awaken the sense of self associated with the heart. And I've actually suggested as you self-remember and you tap yourself on the heart to bring your awareness more into the heart region of your body. In a sense, we want to learn to live in the heart. And in contrast, so much people are, their consciousness is primarily centered in the mind, in the brain, in the head. And in the way we have to cultivate and awaken to this deeper consciousness within the heart. So through this series of programs, we're exploring a series of very profound ideas. The first is the concept of zero point origins. The second is the idea of consciousness and I associated with the heart. And I draw from a wide range of religious and spiritual teachings to try to explicate these ideas. A third thing we've been exploring is the study of metaphysical principles elaborated within the esoteric traditions. So I've been talking about the idea of the law of one, or the unity of creation, and then how that manifests a threefoldedness in the law of three. Everything has a triune nature. And then creation has a sevenfold nature. So I've used this formula, 1 divided by 3 to yield 7, as a model of the kind of metaphysical structure of existence. I've studied these principles in different esoteric teachings, ranging from Blavatsky to Gurdjieff and the Vedas and Kabbalah. So we're trying to discern the meaning of these basic esoteric metaphysical principles. And that's what this zero-point teaching series is about. I would invite, if anyone is out there and would like to call in during the show, we would take calls in the second half of the show, and I'll open it up at some point later. And to call in, you call 877-876-5227. And as I say, I'll open up the lines at a later point in the show. Okay, so I just wanted to have some brief introductory notes and review of some of what the series has addressed so far. But today I'm very pleased to have my longtime friend and associate, James Moffat, back on the line again. James is in Toronto. I live just south of Ottawa. And we're going to discuss what we've called the problem of God's contracting universe. And I'll explain this by giving a little bit of my personal story. Back, it was almost, I guess, late 1970s, and I was first exposed to the Gurdjieff teaching. I was the first what I would call esoteric teaching that I studied. And my main interest was in the psychology of human consciousness. And Gurdjieff emphasized how people are ordinarily so asleep that we're not properly conscious. So how can we study consciousness if we're not properly conscious? So to study consciousness, we have to make efforts to wake up and be more fully conscious. So this is how we have to study consciousness. The Gurdjieff teaching was so profound that through the first years of coming upon this teaching, it certainly gave me so many insights and illuminations and ideas. It was a highly, highly creative and transformative period. And it was during this time that I read Carl Sagan's book called Broca's Brain, Reflections on the Romance of Science. And in the book, Carl Sagan has a chapter entitled A Sunday Sermon. And in this sermon, he addresses the issue of the existence of God and what his personal beliefs were, whether or not he believed in God. And the general thrust of Sagan's arguments is that as science has advanced more and more, there has been less and less for God to do. And he gives an example, saying, we used to think that the God had to say, hey, flower, open. Whereas now, Sagan says, we can explain the opening of the morning glory because we know about the sun and photosynthesis. And so we know these biochemical processes that explain the opening of the flower to the sun. So we don't need God anymore to say, hey, flower, open. These are Sagan's actual words in this kind of amusing chapter. So Sagan then goes on and says, the same is true for the entire skin of causality all the way back to the beginning. As we learn more and more, there seems less and less for God to do. So it's this quotation from Carl Sagan that at that time I used to pose this issue of the problem of God's contracting universe. Is this really so, that as science advances, less reason to believe in God? What is it the scientists have discovered that invalidate religious concepts? And what do the mystics say about those same processes? Now, in writing in that time, I turned my attention from writing my book on Gurdjieff called Psychological Illusions, and I became interested. I started a series which was supposed to run 7 parts, and it was to be called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. And it was supposed to be an inquiry into the existence of God, which looked at the issues of science and religion. And I began that now, it's almost 20 years ago. And my work has evolved considerably since that time, but still basically in pursuit of looking at that question, the issues of science and religion, as these bear upon the question of the existence of God. What I've realized is, most importantly, the question of the existence of God ties into the question of the existence of the human spirit or soul. Is a human being simply a higher primate and material organism, or do we have some spiritual or soul or divine nature that transcends the material body? So the God theory is kind of tied into this soul hypothesis. The idea that there is a living entity within the human being, some kind of soul or spiritual nature. And this series of books was to explore these issues of the enigmas of human consciousness. I could see in Carl Sagan's book, in Broca's Brain, and elsewhere, Carl Sagan says the cerebral cortex is where consciousness is manufactured out of matter. So he suggests that the cerebral cortex, the outer portion of the brain, is where human consciousness is created. And I realize that this is a profound mystery, and Sagan answers it so glibly and so easily and offers really no evidence to substantiate that view. Okay, so I thought the issues of science and religion hinge more upon any other issue. They hinge upon the issue of the origin and nature of human consciousness. So I've often used that, the problem of God's contracting universe, that phrase, to highlight these issues between science and religion. Okay, now I'd like to bring Jim Moffat in here. Hi, Jim, how are you?
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Okay, sorry. I had to try to gain my speed a little bit here, and I'm getting lost a little bit.
I think your presentation of the basic problem of God's contracting universe is quite good. It's the only thing is that it's not 20 years, it's closer to 30 years, because I believe 1979 was when you first began writing about the problem and said that you're going to devote 7 volumes to examining this question, and now it's 27 years later and you're still sort of trying to answer the question, which is interesting.
Yeah, wow. I've got the first two books done of the series.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the third underway.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when you're describing Sagan, one thing that he does write in that Sunday sermon, which is very interesting, is he's talking about belief in God, and he says that when you ask people, well, what do you mean when they say, oh, I believe in God, and you ask people, well, what exactly do you mean when you say God? Well, you know, God. God's everything. God's the creator. And he said, what really, when you examine things, people have very different ideas as to what they mean when they say they believe in God. And he goes on, he pursues that a little bit, and he says that he contrasts the religious point of view of God with a scientific notion of God, in the sense that he says there's the anthropomorphic model of God, which is basically some old guy who's sitting around in his underwear keeping tabs on creation by telling the morning glories to, hey, flower, open, and keeping tabs on how many sparrows there are. And then there's a more scientific view of God, which is the God of Spinoza and Einstein, which is, essentially the sum total of the physical laws which describe the universe, unquote. And then he says, quote, I do not know of any compelling evidence for anthropomorphic patriarchs controlling human destiny from some hidden celestial vantage point, but it would be madness to deny the existence of physical laws. So essentially he's saying, okay, if you're going to recognize a higher power, that higher power is essentially natural and physical laws. And I think, you know, that's an interesting perspective, but it's also, it kind of reveals his own kind of limited conception of God. So it's either like you either have to choose between this old bearded guy or that the natural laws of nature which govern everything.
Yeah, which is exactly the problem, is this kind of caricaturization of mysticism by Sagan, that God is just counting sparrows or talking to the flowers, but
yeah.
No conception of the complex metaphysical teachings within the world's religions, like the metaphysics of the Vedas or the of Kabbalah. Kabbalah study and so on. He has no appreciation of that. So it's that kind of artificial duality between an anthropomorphic God versus the laws of nature.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of a straw man that he sets up. And I mean, I would say it's like it's even his characterization of what the quote unquote mainstream religious people believe. I don't think really most people really do envisage God as, you know, some old bearded guy. I mean, that's the cartoon version. And the other side of it, as you say, there's absolutely no recognition of the esoteric mystical conception and the metaphysical aspects of those teachings that are so much more profound than some sort of old guy sitting around keeping tabs on creation. It's much more complex than that. But it is interesting that's the way he characterizes the situation. And I mean, you know, really what he's voicing in his writings is the essential secular humanist point of view that everything can be explained ethically, he's a secular humanist, and scientifically, of course, he's a materialist. So he subscribes to this materialist view of creation, which eventually everything will be described and explained in terms of natural laws and the processes which govern material creation. And then ethically, he's a secular humanist. So essentially, he pushes religion completely out of the picture. There's no need to invoke a god or a spirit or a soul.
Yeah. I mean, we see that kind of throughout the whole last century of science. It is really in all the main departments of science. No one generally considers mystical viewpoints or interpretations of the body of theory within that area of science. Like, physicists don't look at the findings in physics or the theories and try to relate that to mystical teachings because they don't. They have a materialist interpretation of the facts of different areas of science. Like Sagan says, for instance, you know, now we know about the sun. Okay, well, what is it we know about the sun? Now, from a mystical point of view, the sun is regarded as a level of spiritual intelligences. It is said that human beings, our higher self, in a sense, is within the sun, and that the sun is a living being that intelligently evolves and designs and brings forth organic life on Earth. So what is it Sagan thinks we know about the sun which proves that it's not some living being or some intelligence of some sort? It's not the facts of science so much that deny a mystical perspective. It's the interpretation of the findings in science.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, getting back to Sagan, I mean, you're talking about the history of writing about the problem of God's contracting universe. And I remember when I first read that essay that, in some regards, I mean, he's very critical of the irrationality and the superstition and the dogma that's attached to so many religious teachings kind of all the barbarism that's been committed in the name of religion, and quite frankly, I agree with that. I, my own history is in terms of the churches. I was I was raised in religious upbringing, but was turned off by it, but in a sense because of many of the things that he raises. But then he makes this incredible leap of faith to science, where he just essentially denies the validity and any kind of legitimacy to any kind of religious teaching. And what's very clear as you begin to look at what he's saying is that, and he's not alone in this respect, but as a scientist, he has absolutely no conception of what the mystical or esoteric tradition entails. And so when he's denying the validity of any kind of religious teaching, he's just throwing out the entire body of religious teachings and not really doing so on any kind of evidentiary basis because he doesn't really understand them.
No. Yeah, he doesn't. Exactly.
And you know, the other thing is that kind of going back to his essay, it's really he comes up with this incredible statement later in the same piece where he's talking about this being the most exciting time in human history to be alive because of the astounding and astonishing advances in science, and that science, in trying to answer the most essential questions about the origins and ends of both human beings and the universe, we're in this kind of unique position because we're right on the threshold of these breakthroughs in terms of arriving at scientific understandings, in other words, materialist understandings of these issues. And he says, quote, "Our children will have been taught the answers before most of them will have had an opportunity even to formulate the questions," unquote. This is like the next generation. So he's essentially saying all the major questions are going to be answered within our lifetime, which unfortunately in this case certainly didn't happen, and I don't think in our case it's going to happen either. But and so really, I don't think even many scientists would kind of agree and with that statement. It's almost a messianic statement about the importance of science. And really, what I think it amounts to is what Houston Smith, the theologian, calls scientism, which is really kind of a blind faith in science as the answer to all questions.
Yeah.
I have there's a quote from Houston Smith when he's talking about scientism, which I think is interesting. He's talking about the process, and he says that scientism adds to science. He says that science on balance is good, whereas nothing good can be said of scientism. Scientism adds to science two corollaries. First, that the scientific method is, if not the only reliable method of getting at the truth, then at least the most reliable method. And second, that the things that science deals with, material entities, are the most fundamental things that exist. And then he says, these two corollaries are seldom voiced, for once they are brought to attention, it is not difficult to see that they are arbitrary. Unsupported by facts, they are at best philosophical assumptions, and at worst, merely opinions, unquote. So, essentially, I think that's what, when you first addressed this question, that's what you were addressing, is that, is this really true, that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do? On what basis would anybody reach that conclusion?
Yeah, and then in Sagan's own chapter, his arguments to illustrate it are so superficial, like how, yeah, God has to say, hey, flower, open, or then he talks about, he says, now we have a theory of gravity. The angels don't have to push and pull the planets anymore.
Oh, yeah.
There's another funny example from his selection. But no serious consideration of what is really taught in esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings. I guess that's what I've realized through the last 30 years of studying in this area, is just how broadly there is a cultural ignorance about these subjects, what mystical and spiritual teachings entail and how these compare with modern science. One thing I find is that most people who address the issues of God and religion and science, no one seems to realize the importance of the issue of the nature of human consciousness. Like, it seems to me the contrasting viewpoints of the head doctrine and the heart doctrine, that's a basis on which you can compare the perspectives on a scientific basis. So it's not simply a matter of belief, but it's alternative model of creation is actually offered in mystical teachings. That's what no one seems to appreciate, that they're serious scientific hypotheses offered within the esoteric literature. I guess that's when I was addressing Sagan. That's what I was hoping to do, is to show that, yes, indeed, and this is what some of the mystics say, and this is how it applies to science and psychology and consciousness studies. It's like Blavatsky in 1888 said, the occult side of nature has never been approached by modern civilization. And I think it's 100 years since, over 100 since The Secret Doctrine was published, and I'd still say that's true. No one considers the occult side of nature.
Yeah, I think along the same lines, in one of his, I think it's perhaps in A New Model of the Universe, Uspensky says something to the effect that esotericism is the idea least understood by most people in modern times, and that the esoteric tradition has existed throughout human history, and that the idea that there have been schools or organizations which are devoted to developing methods of awakening and developing higher states of consciousness, and that these ideas and methods are transmitted through these special organizations to certain pupils who pass certain initiations and rites of passage, and that these this tradition has run throughout history and appeared in different guises in different times and places, but that there's an ongoing perennial philosophy, I think is the term that Huxley used, that of these ideas, and that they run throughout human history, and that they're devoted to the idea of transforming consciousness. And when I first started studying the Fourth Way, Gurdjieff Uspensky material, I realized very soon in studying how, as you say, most people have absolutely, even most very educated people have absolutely no idea of the existence of this tradition. It's really quite an astounding mystery that these ideas are out there. There are thousands of books about them. It's not like that they're hidden in a sense, but they're not hidden at all. And yet they, in certain so-called learned circles, they have absolutely no impact.
Yeah. Yes, I think, I mean, the two areas I focused on that I think that's most true of, the first is studies of consciousness, because the mystical teachings do provide alternative models of consciousness. And the second is in terms of studying creation dynamics, because there's such profound correlations between modern scientific views of creation and ancient metaphysical accounts of creation. Particularly, in the concept of zero-point sources, like the idea of how the modern scientist traces the universe, the origin of the universe, to a singularity condition, whereas Blavatsky in 1888, a century earlier, described essentially the same thing, the zero-point origins of the universe. So I think especially in terms of consciousness studies and creation studies, that there is this widespread of mystical teachings, and I think that's a real shame, because it tends then to bifurcate, or like to separate the religion from science, and to see them as opposing ideas or teachings. And religion is having no merit, but it's simply a matter of belief and dogma, whereas science is objective and has practical results. So I think instead what's most essential is that we develop something that incorporates both the scientific, what's valuable in the scientific approach, but also include human consciousness in the equation. And then have an approach to mystical science, to apply the mystical framework of understanding to the facts of science and to the interpretation of the facts of science. That was the idea when I was going to write a 7-part series of books. I was going to apply the laws of 3 and 7 to different areas in science to show their application and to show how these laws provided a model of creation. That was part of it, and then the other part dealt with all the consciousness studies and how we have to include consciousness in the equation. So really, I think the public debate between religion and science has kind of missed out on recognizing the most fundamental issues in questions that we have to face.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it's... I think what the mystical perspective provides is how, there's a book by C.P. Snow, The Two Cultures, about science and religion, and it's famous work in dealing with this. Many of the things that I read about science and religion, it's always the arguments discussion is always formulated in this, in terms of this dichotomy between science and religion. And what I think the esoteric mystical perspective provides is a third perspective. It's a force that's missing from this normal debate. And I guess originally when I first studied the Fourth Way, which was the first esoteric teaching that I studied, what changed everything for me was the idea that that consciousness could be transformed. And I very quickly came to realize that this idea that we are capable of developing higher states of consciousness within ourselves, which we could actually make permanent, not just like, you know, momentary glimpses of higher realities, but that we could actually develop these higher states of consciousness within ourselves. It changed everything because it's a perspective which is completely non-existent within modern thought. It's just not acknowledged at all. And that there were these ancient teachings, the idea that there were these ancient teachings which not only asserted this, but that there were people who seemed to have embodied this, it just changed everything. Now, the other side of it for me was that I didn't necessarily automatically assume that transformation was spiritual or that it led to a religious point of view. But over time, I think that I began to realize that the transformation of consciousness is a psycho-spiritual transformation, that it's undeniable that there's a spiritual element to the transformation of consciousness, and that really awakening to consciousness means awakening to spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like this. I think maybe in ways people have a wrong understanding of spirit based on coming from a religion. And so I don't think I felt especially spiritual in my early interests. I was interested in consciousness and didn't assume it to be spiritual. I think more of those terms become more meaningful as we kind of progress in understanding consciousness and realizing the kind of freedom in spirit. I'm just going to read this quote here. I just related to what you were saying. I can't quite find the quote, but it's the one from Nickel talking about... Oh, no, it's from Rodney Collins.
I was going to say Rodney Collins, yeah.
And he says, the scientist, he searches for unity, but... He searches for unity in an ordinary state of consciousness. And he says, imagine a scientist who kind of trips over, you know, can never find his umbrella, and he trips over the stool, and he fails to know when he irritates his wife, and he's subject to all the same trivial characteristics of everybody in everyday life. Now, what kind of unity can such a scientist reach if he's not unified within himself in the ordinary state of consciousness? So the idea is unifying knowledge is only, we can only acquire it if we ourselves attain a certain awakening and development of unity within ourselves. Otherwise, it's, you know, we might have ideas of the unified fields theories, but those ideas, we don't include ourselves in the equations.
I guess for me, it's funny that you picked up on that, because what I was leading to when I was talking about the idea of transformation of consciousness, I remember one of the things that reading in the fourth way, and which became more and more real to me as I attempted to awaken, you know, through my own efforts and realizing how hard it was to awaken, and that really my normal waking consciousness was a waking sleep. But was the idea, I realized that Gurdjieff says that in, you know, the higher states of consciousness, that then you know objective reality, that really the only objective knowledge can be attained through the transformation of consciousness and the realization of these higher states within oneself. Only then can you see through the illusions that are the product of our normal waking state of consciousness. And I think for me, very early on, that became a very real idea, and I think that's an idea that's completely that most people completely misunderstand, even if they think about it, or just don't recognize that mystical and esoteric teachings provide, is that the realization of these higher states of consciousness is not a subjective thing. It's actually, it's a more objective thing. It's a more objective experience than any experience at a lower state, so-called normal waking consciousness. I found that quote actually from Colin at the beginning. He says, in every age, men have tried to assemble all the knowledge and experience of their day into a single whole, which would explain their relation to the universe and their possibilities in it. In the ordinary way, they could never succeed. for the unity of things is not realizable by the ordinary mind in an ordinary state of consciousness. The ordinary mind, refracted by countless and contradictory promptings of different sides of human nature, must reflect the world as manifold and confused as is man himself. A unity, a pattern, an all-embracing meaning, if it exists, could only be discerned or experienced by a different kind of mind, in a different state of consciousness. It would only be realizable by a mind which has become itself unified.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he goes say that, you know, how can even the most brilliant physicist or philosopher, be unified if he fails to notice that he irritates his wife and that, he trips over a stool, it becomes angry at being shortchanged, you know, all the things that characterize everyone's life in a normal waking state of consciousness.
Yeah, so what unifying knowledge or objective knowledge can we attain in such a state? And none is.
None,
so
exactly.
Really, it's requiring this deeper transformation to attain what Gurdjieff would call objective knowledge.
Yes.
So higher states of consciousness, instead of being just subjective, fanciful kind of states, it's you perceive more objective reality. So in a way, it's like you pierce veils of nature and realize the underlying unity and interrelatedness of things. It's interesting. I like how Gurdjieff uses the term objective science. Like he says, modern scientists know nothing of objective science. So, and then what is objective science to Gurdjieff? Partly it's a study of the laws of 3 and 7. That to him is objective science. But in our ordinary state, we have no idea how, like, the meaning of the laws of 3 and 7, how could those be objective formula or have such a meaning or value. So then the importance of developing consciousness as a route to trying to understand the issues of science and religion. So we have to, as René Weber says, we have to include ourselves in the equation. I like her description of, she says, scientists strive for unity, but they leave themselves out of the equations. And he says, mystics, in a way, they have to go further because they have to crack this structure of the ego, which limits their perception. So they have to take consciousness into the equation. So she suggests that mystics may end up being more scientific, really, than scientists. I think that's what happened to me over time. I began to realize that in many ways, the mainstream of science is really pseudo-scientific. The philosophy underlying it is pseudo-scientific. I think that's when I, at one point, I realized what a huge volume of evidence there is for paranormal phenomena, ranging from near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, psychokinesis, ESP, remote viewing, ghosts, all these kinds of phenomena that if you look at it throughout the history of humankind, there have been innumerable cases and studies and investigations of all these kinds of phenomena. And it's like modern scientists simply close their eyes to the existence of all these evidences which contradict their own materialist philosophy. So it's like, as Uspensky says, the scientists close their eyes to all these system-destroying facts. So modern science has for the last century, despite the overwhelming evidence for existence out of the body or after death, no scientists consider seriously what would be the scientific basis by which this could work. How could we live in a multidimensional universe and have multidimensional existence? Scientists don't even consider such possibilities. Instead, because they assume we're simply material organisms, they then have to close their eyes to this huge, vast amount of evidences that there's something much deeper happening, that there is, you know, that beings do persist beyond the death of the physical body, and instances of ESP and meaningful coincidences and such occur all the time in everybody's life. So if we take all these evidences, I remember Uspensky saying, if you took all these evidences and gathered them all together, it would almost wash away everything we think we know. And modern science has made no attempt, really, to understand how these things might be possible. That was part of the idea of the God Contracting Universe series, was the marshalling of all these evidences to show that indeed the scientific evidences which disprove this materialist assumptive framework of Carl Sagan and others. Okay, Jim.
Well, I was just going to say that, I guess that was for me that when I began to when you began that series and I started, I thought, well, you know, on some level, I certainly see how an esoteric conceptualization of consciousness can lead to a critique of modern science and can challenge the assumptive framework of modern science, and that really. The material monism, which is the dominant philosophical position in which most of the modern science is based, doesn't really hold up. I mean, when you take it to its ultimate limits, it collapses, and it's sort of a situation akin to that which is in physics, where Newtonian physics existed for a couple of hundred years, and it describes things very adequately within certain limits. But then along came relativity and quantum mechanics, and it revealed that, you know, that Newtonian mechanics, it didn't invalidate Newtonian mechanics, but it showed the limits of Newtonian mechanics. And I would say that as you start to look from a mystical and esoteric perspective at modern science, you come to the same conclusion. And there's no way that a mystical perspective invalidates the facts of science. It just reveals the limits of the interpretations of certain facts in science. And that's where Sagan and other materialist scientists exceed their authority in a sense, because they make all sorts of pronouncements about the nature of reality which are not at all based on scientific fact. They're interpretations and extensions of ideas, interpretations and extensions of ideas in science, but they're not scientific facts. I mean, there's nothing, if you look at the history of science, there's nothing in science where somebody disproves the existence of spirit or of metaphysical realities or God. These ideas were all banished from science because they were incompatible with a certain philosophical viewpoint.
Yeah, the paradigm. They were inconsistent with
the
paradigm.
Yeah, they don't
fit
the paradigm,
that
so they're sort of pushed to the side. But they haven't been invalidated. Science has never disproved the existence of spirit. It just, you know, it just hasn't happened. And that's where when Carl Sagan and various other scientists make all sorts of meta-theoretical statements about the nature of man and God and law in the universe, well, those aren't scientific statements. Those are statements of opinion. I mean, they may be right, they may be wrong, but they're not scientific facts, and they're certainly not scientific in the strict sense of the word.
Yeah, it's like when a scientist has an opinion, then we end up thinking it's a scientific opinion. It really is just an opinion that happened to be held by a scientist.
Only scientists can hold scientific opinions. I don't know. It's the other.
Sagan touts himself. Oh, I believe so much in science, and this is my opinion. So in a way, it's like that's the scientific opinion, is that human beings have no spirit or soul nature.
Yeah,
that's considered a scientific opinion. But that's incompletely in disregard of all the vast evidences for all kinds of inexplicable phenomena and evidences. It kind of just negates all of that, and it's based on the whole assumptive framework that the brain and the head produces consciousness. Like, everyone assumes the cerebral cortex is what produces consciousness, but no one has proven that. No one can say what the consciousness is. It's just simply, again, assumed that the brain or the mind produces consciousness. And we end up thinking those assumptions are scientific perspectives, but really they're just assumptions.
Yeah, I guess, one other aspect of this that we haven't talked about is in Sagan's writings and those of many other scientists and science writers who adhere to a materialist viewpoint, you often hear them dismiss things as being mystical. And for them, the terms mysticism and mystical refer to things which are insubstantial or ultimately subjective or vaguely formulated or at best some sort of spontaneous experience of some sort of transcendent knowledge or realization, but that these things are in no way quote-unquote scientific. And so essentially there any such ideas are inferior to science, and that's a consistent theme that runs through all of modern scientific writing and science writing, is that anything mystical is essentially second rate. And the incredible irony of all this, of course, is that, as you said earlier, that Rene Weber points out that both scientists and mystics search for unity, and it may be that in a sense, the mystic is more scientific than the scientist, because the mystic includes himself in his search for the unifying equation. And in fact, if you look at the history of 20th century physics, we now know that the observational process is deeply implicated in what is observed. So in a sense, science in the 20th century has come to the viewpoint that the observer has to be included somehow in the equation. They just haven't figured out how to do it, and that's the.
Or they don't think there's different levels of observation.
Yeah,
almost,
well,
right?
that's the other side.
Everyone, all the observers are on the same level. They don't think that. Oh, you could have an observer in a heightened state of consciousness that gives him more objective experience than a person in an egoically conditioned state of consciousness.
Precisely, and that also applies to religion, and in the original formulation of your problem of God's contracting universe, you dealt with Carl Sagan's viewpoints, and then you contrasted them with the Swami, who talked about knowing God and the importance of knowing that having a direct experience of God was much more relevant and important than knowing that the scientific principles that govern natural phenomena. And in a sense, the debate was between science and religion. But then the other side of everything is that in the fourth way, you have this description of people in the normal waking state of consciousness that are divided into what Gurdjieff calls man number one, two, and three, and that in man number one is someone who's dominated by their physical, moving, instinctual processes. Like, that's their primary center of consciousness, and man number two is an emotional person, is dominated by their emotional intelligence, and man number three is dominated by the intellectual intelligence. But all three of those people are on the same level, because they're normal waking, they're in a normal waking state of consciousness, which in Gurdjieff's scheme is a lower state of consciousness. But then there's the man number four, which is somebody who is self-conscious, and then there's a man number five, which is another higher level of consciousness. And he says at one point that man number one, man number two, and man number three, people in the normal waking state of consciousness, there are different religions for each of those people, and that these religions appeal to the different types of people and reinforce different religious conceptualizations. And that's kind of a concept that Sagan clearly doesn't recognize, but even in your own writing, like, it's not really sort of spelled out that, as you say, just as you just said about, you know, the scientific observations, it's also true of religious observations, that there's the religious observations of the lower states of consciousness, and then there's religious observations of the higher states of consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
And so when we talk about the debate between science and religion, really we have to talk about the debate between, well, what kind of science, what kind of religion, what level of consciousness are you talking about? And the other side of it too is that I had a discussion with a fellow about this, about when I said that in a sense esotericism can be thought of a science as being a science of consciousness and being, and he really objected to me using the term science because he said, well, for me, I know what science is. You know, there's nothing vague about it. Science is a certain procedure, it's a certain method, it adheres to certain rules. And what I think he was trying to say was that what you're talking about is essentially a subjective experience. And what I was trying to argue to him was, no, in some ways, what I'm talking about when I say a science of consciousness and being is that those who attain higher states of consciousness actually have a more objective knowledge of certain things than is attainable by science as we ordinarily understand it, and so it's a very rigorous and a very exacting process, and it leads to objective descriptions of reality.
Yeah, it's people don't appreciate that they have that pejorative view of mysticism as more fanciful and non-scientific. I mean, even when you look into mystical teachings and practices themselves, they're very rigorous and they're very scientific, and you learn by experimenting on yourself through experimentation and observation. It's not just reading and knowledge of something, it's actual being, it's actual experience of phenomena. So you're trying to validate the concepts through your own self-study.
Yeah, exactly, and they're empirically based because people observe certain aspects of consciousness and repeatedly observe them, and people observe the same things, and so just as in science you have a marshaling, a collection and a marshaling of facts and experiences and interpretations. You have the same thing in the science of consciousness and being. In esoteric teachings, is that it's incredibly rigorous and it's quite objective. I mean, you know, different approaches obviously will emphasize different aspects of the dynamics of transforming consciousness, but within teachings you'll find the same phenomena occurring again and again because they're there.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess that's where my own experience. I became interested in the study of consciousness originally from within a Western psychological viewpoint and perspective, studying modern psychology and Freud and Jung and different psychologists and philosophers. But then over time, I realized, wow, we should also make an effort to study the ideas and teachings of those people who are claimed to have attained higher states of consciousness or self-realization. And that kind of led me to reading more and more widely in the different writings of yogis and swamis and rabbis and so on, people who are supposed to have made some attainment in their own consciousness. Development. So we really should study, if we're interested in consciousness, we should study the ideas and teachings of those people who have striven to attain higher consciousness through their own inner process.
So you would agree with the statement from Daphne John, who says, if we had a direct connection to an objective universe, we would not have to go to such lengths to find out about it scientifically.
if we had such a direct life,
yes,
say
if we had, he says if we had a direct connection to an objective universe, we wouldn't have to study it. So we wouldn't have to go to such lengths to study it scientifically.
It's complex. I'm not sure. I think we might still do that, like study it in various aspects in science. But I think the experience through higher states gives you a different model and interpretive scheme. And so it kind of puts everything in order in a different way. I'm not sure. I don't quite get the Adidas quote. I mean, in a way, yes, if we were experiencing those states, we wouldn't, while we're in those states, we don't need to prove anything scientifically.
That's what I think he's trying to say. I think he's trying to say is that, it's, in another way, he's trying to say what Rodney Collin was saying earlier, is that, you know, if you seek the unity directly, you won't have to seek it through the accumulation of facts. You know, that he's saying that science, in a sense, is a mediated experience of the universe, and that there are more direct and objective ways of experiencing it directly experientially through the development of consciousness.
Because my experience also has been, like, sometimes you experience, I think sometimes I've had experiences of more objective realizations and consciousness, but then afterwards I'm trying to understand that scientifically, like what is that? So it's a kind of a dual process. I became interested in the study of states of samadhi, okay, and you know the quotation from my book about Yogananda's experiences of samadhi, and in states of samadhi, like Yogananda's experience, he's sitting in his ashram one day, and his teacher says, "Poor Yogananda, nothing can fulfill your heart's desire," and he leans over and he taps Yogananda above the heart. And that kind of awakens Yogananda within the heart. And then he describes, he says, "My consciousness streamed out of my body like light." And he was then aware of everything in the whole volume of space around him in the ashram where he was. It was like his awareness was interpenetrating a whole volume of space. So instead of being confined to his body, he was interpenetrating a whole area of space, experiencing everything within himself. Okay, now that, would you agree, Jim, that would be an experience of objective consciousness?
Yes.
Okay, so what it's showing you is at some level you're interconnected to the whole environment and that your consciousness can expand into it. And Yogananda goes on to describe how he began to experience like the whole of the earth within himself, and then the whole of the solar system, and ultimately the whole of the universe, he said. And then it's like his consciousness came right back into his body, and all of a sudden he says it felt like he was confined to the narrow body once again after kind of experiencing this explosion of cosmic consciousness. So those were glimpses of objective consciousness which showed him deep truths about the deep structures of reality. But when he comes back, it's not that he could explain to someone else the science of what it is involved in that or how that works. That doesn't automatically follow from it.
No.
No.
I was just going to say it's interesting when you bring up that experience, because that's a book that you and I both read probably 30 years ago, and you read an experience. It's a wonderful book, and he has extraordinary descriptions of a variety of experiences, and also he's also provides scientific commentary in terms of like relativity and on various aspects of consciousness, but when I heard you reading that, I was thinking that's the kind of thing. There's an experience that an intelligent human being had, and yet within the mainstream of modern science and modern thought, that is a completely ignored experience. I mean, that his commentary is ignored. is ignored, and those are ideas that are, if they're true, are staggering in their implications for our understanding of essentially everything, and yet they're just completely ignored. So I guess just thinking of it in terms of the problem of God's contracting universe, when you first formulated this critique of Sagan, were you thinking in terms of experiences like that of higher states of consciousness? Was that part of what you were reacting to, or were you reacting to Sagan's dismissal of religion and the existence of God, or was it? I mean, you said earlier you also had interest in talking about the laws of three and seven, or was it all of those things together that led you to raise this problem of God's contracting universe?
Yeah, I think it was kind of all of them together. You know, as I was saying earlier, I was at the time trying to understand the enigmas of consciousness and realizing what a profound mystery that was. So, but at the same time, I've always been interested in science and creation. So I was interested in the portrayal of religion. That was a second aspect of it. But I think also most importantly, during that time, I had different kinds of psychical experiences and had experiences of being out of my body and traveling and meaningful patterns of coincidences and ESP occurrences occur, all these of which show that there are complex patterns of interrelatedness between events in our lives that aren't simply coincidental, but these seemingly separate incidents and events are interconnected in the subtle, hidden causal matrix. There has to be something much far deeper. Like, I remember one time, I remember the story, I was visiting Ottawa, and I while I was there, I was staying at Laurie's house at the time, and I had to prepare a lecture while I was there. And I remember my lecture happened to be on Carl Jung, and whenever I would bring Carl Jung up, I would usually find that a series of meaningful coincidences would occur during those times when I would lecture on Jung. So this year, as I sat there at Laurie's table, and I thought to myself, okay, this year I want to have three meaningful coincidences happen. And just then the telephone rang, and it was you. And you were calling me. You said, "Oh, hi, Chris. Before I talk to you, I just want to ask you one question. My friend Bob Cross is here, and he wants to know, do you have a copy of Arthur Koestler's The Roots of Coincidence?" Okay? Remember that, Jim?
Well, it was kind of like, actually, what we were trying to do is this other guy and I were trying to think of what was the name of the book that Arthur Koestler wrote on coincidence.
Okay.
We couldn't think of the name of it. We both read it, and I phoned you just at that moment when you said, right, well, I'm trying to have three coincidences happen.
Yeah, and you wanted the title of that book.
Yeah,
and you didn't
know
I was lecturing on Jung or that I was preparing a lecture, you know.
Completely unrelated on some level, but obviously on some other level. And of course, you know, I had the same thing that was one of the things I first noticed when I first started to study myself systematically in terms of the fourth way and to study my consciousness, is that I had repeated instances of coincidences and synchronicities, and that they seemed to revolve around certain themes all the time too. And it was just so startling how often things happened that it was like it felt meaningful. And you know, of course, Sagan would have a field day with that and say, "Oh, there's all sorts of rational explanations as to why you would, you know, you notice certain things and you're selecting in terms of interpretation, preconceived ideas, and then you're noticing those things." But boy, it didn't feel like that. I completely disagree with that interpretation. Yeah. That's part of it too, I guess, on some level, is that things feel different, and it's not just subjective. There's feeling and then there's feeling. Sometimes you have feelings that are just so strong that you know on some level that they're true, you know? Or at least it seems that they're true. And I guess that was part of it too, is that with synchronicities, that it just seemed to feel so meaningful that these things were happening.
I guess I trying to bring it back a bit to what we were talking about. You're asking what influences, like what did I have in mind in addressing Sagan and the problem of God's contracting universe, was that at that time there was also, I'd had a different psychical experiences and had begun studying the research on parapsychology and became more and more convinced there's overwhelming evidence for these phenomena. And many of these people who research, they're serious researchers, just
yes.
like the researchers in other areas are. There's no a priori reason to dismiss someone's research just because we disagree with it. Like, I remember another example was the dream telepathy experiments. Like,
right.
those people tried to be scientifically rigorous
right.
and, you know, had all kinds of... They were scientific in their method and had all kinds of controls built in and everything. And they got very meaningful results. So how, there's no basis to be scientific. We can't simply dismiss all these evidences which question our assumptions. And it strikes me also that one of the things that I read that influenced me a lot, at one point when I was reading Raymond Moody's work on life after life and a series of other books that came out on near-death experiences. And one, in reading these books, I realized that in all the accounts, these people are outside of their bodies, apparently, but they're still conscious, they still have their personal identity, they still have memory, sensation, emotions, even though they're outside of their body. In fact, the research suggests that when people are outside of their bodies, they feel almost completely the same as what they feel when they're in their bodies. They feel almost completely themselves, even though there are some slight differences. Which I found that so significant, because then I realized, oh, that would suggest that even while we're in our body, it's not simply the mind producing consciousness. We never were simply the mind. Really, this inner being self-awareness is not produced by the body at all. The body more is a vehicle that our essential I inhabits. So I found that very kind of insightful into like the showing me the necessity of trying to develop an alternate way of trying to understand human consciousness, that there has to be some deeper physics and metaphysics to it. So I think, you know, it was different influences that, you know, I thought in responding to Carl Sagan and the problem of God's contracting universe, I thought I had some very original angles on this whole debate between science and religion. Feeling that beginning, as I've mentioned, with the idea that we have to look at views of consciousness, which are critical in this debate. Is consciousness produced by material processes, or is there some spirit or soul, whatever that might be? That's a critical issue in this debate. And the second is, that the scientists in dismissing mysticism really have no ideas of what these perspectives entail. They don't consider seriously the metaphysics that is taught. Instead, they consider religion only in its exoteric form as a system of dogmas and rituals and beliefs, but they don't consider the esoteric side of religion. thus, as you were saying before, what really is science and what really is religion? Like, in a way, religion isn't real religion, and science isn't real science. So somehow there's a fundamental misunderstanding in the debate and in our use of terms. Okay, so where are we here? So let's see, it's almost 10 after 5. I don't know if there's any calls. I'll give the number out again if anyone was inclined to call in and provide some comments. The number is 877-876-5227. And you can just address the question to Jim or I, or just contribute to our discussion as you might please. Okay, Jim, any further angle or thoughts here?
Well, I just, you know, I was just listening when you were making these comments. I mean, I remember, I think actually before we both were studying psychic phenomena before we got into the fourth way and the Gurdjieff Uspensky material and
was it? It was before.
Yeah,
that.
I think that, I think actually
you're right.
When you first read In Search of the Miraculous, it was recommended to you by someone who said, "Well, you're interested in psychic phenomena, you should read this book because it'll provide you with a different perspective on things." Even like with the Yogananda's experience, what struck me when first reading the conceptualization of consciousness that's presented in the fourth way, when it was that these ideas about consciousness existing hierarchically, like that there being different gradations of consciousness and different levels of consciousness, I realized that perspective provided a model in which all these things that you were talking about, like all these psychic phenomena, the idea of consciousness existing apart from the body, the idea of cosmic consciousness, experiences of cosmic consciousness, all these were explicable in terms of this model that was presented in the fourth way. And it changed everything in terms of my own understanding of things and the possibilities of understanding things. I mean, one of the things that materialists always say about psychic phenomena and about all sorts of paranormal phenomena, well, there's no explanation of how these things could occur. But when you look at an esoteric conceptualization of consciousness, they're all completely explicable in terms of it's because of our limited understanding, scientific understanding of consciousness, that these things aren't explicable. And in fact, as interesting as your work's developed, is that what becomes apparent is that many of the things that befuddle physicists are explicable. Something like the EPR paradox is completely explicable in terms of this model of consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, it gives such a unique perspective on so many enigmas in physics. Like, it strikes me that Blavatsky's descriptions of zero-point dynamics gives a profound perspective on the uncertainty principle in modern physics. It's as if, according to the uncertainty position in physics, we cannot specify the position and momentum of a quanta we can only specify to a certain degree of accuracy, and there's always a residual uncertainty. And if you try to specify one quality perfectly accurately, the other quality becomes completely unknown. So if you try to know its position exactly of the quanta, its energy level is infinitely variable. So it seems to pass into infinity. Or if you try to measure its energy level, its position becomes completely unknown. So it's as you try to measure one property, the other becomes infinite. Now, it's as if there's an infinite being that underlies creation. So if you take any finite thing and you try to examine the innermost nature of any finite element, it leads back into the infinite. so that you're going to reach a certain level where the finite passes over into the infinite through the zero-point dynamic. So in a way, the uncertainty principle, there has to be that uncertainty, because any finite thing resolves back into the infinite. So you can only examine something on a certain level. And if you penetrate into the innermost nature of anything, it passes into the infinite. It passes beyond our view. That's just one example where I thought, like, some of Blavatsky's teaching gives this kind of profound alternative perspective on one of the most enigmatic features in modern physics.
Well, I've never heard the uncertainty principle explained quite like that. Thanks for clearing that up.
did you grasp what
I even knowing about zero points, I had never thought of it at all in those terms. I follow what you're saying, and I'd never even thought of that would follow
follows from that. Yeah, that if you apply it.
Wow.
Like consider. This is a quotation, like Blavatsky says, a neutral center is in one respect a limiting point of a given set of senses. Sorry, I have to. Thus imagine two consecutive planes of matter as already formed, each of these corresponding to an appropriate set of perceptive organs. We are forced to admit that between these two planes of matter an incessant circulation takes place. And if we follow the atoms or molecules of, say, the lower in their transformation upwards, these will come to a point where they will pass altogether beyond the range of the faculties we are using on the lower plane. In fact, to us, the matter of the lower plane there vanishes from our perception into nothing, or rather it passes onto the higher plane. And the state of matter corresponding to such a point of transition must certainly possess special and not readily discernible properties. That's an awkward quote, but it's like you try to specify a quanta to a point, and you go so far, and then the point just disappears, and it opens up into another realm. It passes into the infinite.
Another dimension, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So, okay, but anyway, sorry, I let us stay a little bit there. Before that, we were talking about, what do we come back to? We're talking about science and mysticism.
Oh, we're just talking about, I commented that for me, I think what you were describing too is for me that when I started to study the fourth way and the conceptualization of consciousness, the hierarchy of consciousness, it made all these enigmatic and anomalous phenomena appear explicable. That's one of the things that really excited me about it, because I began to see how it was possible to explain certain phenomena in terms of this model of consciousness. And I guess one of the other things too is the idea that consciousness is not defined as being the contents of awareness or the equated with the psychic functions, but consciousness was something substantial, and that it existed at different gradients of materiality, and so that really consciousness permeated the universe on different levels, and that whole conceptualization just led to a completely different understanding of things.
The idea, consciousness illuminates the material side of nature and different realms of material nature. I see it like consciousness is like light can illuminate the physical body, so you can be conscious in the physical body. But if the physical body wasn't there, then that consciousness can be conscious through the astral body, and then the mind body, the mental body. So we have these different bodies or clothes, but the consciousness is different from the physical body or the astral body or the mental body. It's like that pure being self-awareness or illumination, and then we can be conscious within different bodies, and then that could explain how we could be conscious within different planes. Like I noted before how you were saying how scientists say, oh, there's no model for how these phenomena could exist. But if you go to the mystical literature, there's lots of models of how these paranormal phenomena exist. Like, because we said we have three lower bodies, a mental body, an astral body, and the physical body. And each of those levels of existence is described as sevenfold. So it said, for example, if after death you pass into the astral plane, you might pass into seven levels of the astral plane according to the development of your astral body. So it's a model of how you have different subtle bodies that exist within different subtle planes interpenetrating one another. So it does provide the basis for a model of multidimensional consciousness.
Yeah.
And then if we take light, consciousness as light, and that light can illuminate through the different bodies, well then, yeah.
Yeah, just to take these things back to, you know, Sagan and to his original essay, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention earlier was that, you know, in his critique of religion, essentially what he's, his celebration of science, essentially what he's putting forward is an epistemological argument. And you know, epistemology is the study of how we know. And his whole position is, his assumption is that the study of material observable processes is the most reliable way of knowing something. And it's interesting that because he subscribes to this idea, because he ignores mystical and esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness, he seems to believe that consciousness must be the product of these material processes in the brain, and that's the position he puts forth. He argues that in The Dragons of Eden and also in Cosmos. You made that quote where he says essentially that consciousness emerges out of the cerebral cortex. That's where consciousness is manufactured. But, you know, this is a guy who's a scientist, but when you look at it, there's really absolutely no evidence for that point of view. None. I mean,
no
there just isn't. Nobody's ever observed, you know, consciousness being produced in the cerebral cortex. Nobody's ever observed a material process producing consciousness. It just, but the evidence just doesn't exist for that. And so it's kind of ironic that, you know, when you begin to study the mystical and esoteric ideas and you see this consistent presentation of a model of consciousness, I mean, the details differ from teaching to teaching, but certain common elements run through all these teachings, you realize that you know, it's really intellectual laziness in a sense that leads people to these ideas of the pejorative views of mysticism and esotericism. Well, they don't even know about esotericism, but the pejorative use of the term mystical. And really, these ideas are extremely profound and extremely consistent. And, you know, really, there's no basis to dismiss them at all. In fact, that they should be explored.
Yeah. Yeah. And, particularly, I think, the important issue of the multidimensional existence. Like,
yeah.
This, in science today, people in society today think that the scientific viewpoint is that consciousness ends at death. They think that's a scientific viewpoint. Really, there's no evidence for that, there's no evidence because we don't know what consciousness is and can't explain the phenomena, and there's also a wide variety of evidences that suggest there is existence beyond death and within the multidimensional universe, and it's like science has simply assumed this, that life ends at death. And yet, this is really the most important question that needs to be discovered or addressed by scientists, is to determine this and how indeed we might exist as multidimensional beings. Like the existence beyond death is a profoundly important scientific viewpoint or important area of study. And then it's like if we think, okay, then if we could exist beyond death then and exist within different realms of existence, then there has to be a physics to these levels, physics and metaphysics to these higher dimensions. And so we need to develop models of how we could be higher dimensional beings living within different bodies in different times. Like, but this whole area has been ignored. People haven't attempted to model it other than from within the esoteric traditions. So I guess I have always felt that to truly be scientists, it reminds me of Eddington's quote, Sir James Eddington,
Arthur.
Where I remember his quote, you told it to me many years ago, he says, I forget exactly, but the idea in science is to put in order the evidences of experience.
Yeah, it's Arthur Eddington, and I think the quote is...
Arthur, yeah.
If I recall correctly, I think the quote is that he defined science as the earnest attempt to set in order the facts of experience.
Yeah, and now if we really take human experiences, well, people have experiences of being out of body, out of bodies, and telepathic events, and meaningful coincidences. So if we take these are all experiences and seeming evidences, then if we need a model of science, a model of creation that uses those evidences as clues to us as to how what the underlying reality must be. Like, in a way, that's why I got to a certain point in my life where I just said, okay, I accept it. Like, at one point, I was going to do parapsychology research, and then I realized, oh, it's useless doing more parapsychology research. There's been hundreds of parapsychologists. They've all showed these phenomena occur. I'd just be one more name showing the existence of a phenomena. So my feeling was we have to go further. So I began to try to assume, okay, we're multidimensional beings. Consciousness is not produced by the brain. How then could it work? What could be the hidden dimensions of existence that allow these phenomena to occur? So I worked from that angle instead of, as a skeptic, always, anytime he's faced with a phenomena that's incongruent within the materialist science, it could be this or it could be that or it could be something else. And he always wanted more evidences. Whereas I took the opposite. I said, okay, let's accept it's true. How could it work? We have to develop a different model of the nature of what a human being is.
Yeah, that was one thing in your work that I always found very interesting was that, I mean, by nature I'm kind of skeptical about everything, and I think that, you know, in reading parapsychology, I mean, I think some of the research is very convincing. Others, you know, there are alternative explanations or the research is sloppy. But if you apply the same standards to most of modern psychology, you wouldn't have much left that's of any validity whatsoever, because you can pick holes in pretty much any kind of experiment or any kind of body of work. You know, it's there.
Exactly.
What I really liked that you did was to say, okay, we've got all these descriptions and accounts, both experimental and anecdotal, and I think, you know, anecdotal information is extremely important. Just because it's not scientific, it's not in a laboratory, it doesn't mean it's not important, you know. There are certain things like, you know, experiencing yourself outside of your body is kind of hard to produce in a lab, but if you had the experience, then you might want to try to explain it. And I always liked that about your approach was, okay, let's do a what if, and I mean, you could describe it as like a thought experiment, like Einstein did. You know, Einstein never did an experiment in his life. He did thought experiments. What if all these things are valid? What would account for them? How would we have to think about the nature of what it means to be human in order to account for these phenomena? And that was what was so interesting about the fourth way, was that here is a model of consciousness in which all of these things were possible. Completely possible and completely explicable in terms of that model, and that's what just threw me a complete loop was that, oh, okay, well, if you posit the existence of a substantive consciousness and the existence of subtle realms and of subtle being bodies, then all of these things are possible. It is possible to be conscious outside your body.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, to be telepathic and, you know, a variety of other things are all true. I want to go back to one thing also in the original Sagan formulation, which I think is really interesting and which I think kind of shows the shallowness of his presentation, which is that when he's criticizing religion, he says something to the effect he's talking about the advent of science and explanations in terms of natural phenomena and material processes. And he says, you know, that throughout human history's attempts to get at the explanation of our origins and ends, both of human beings and the universe, explanations have been the province of, quote, philosophers and poets, theologians and shamans, unquote. And then he says, quote, the sheer diversity and extensive disagreement, unquote, that characterizes those answers means that most of them must be wrong. And he goes on to say the same thing about religious teachings. He says there's so many different religious teachings. Clearly, because there's so many different religious teachings, most of them must be wrong. But, I mean, given the fact that, first of all, there are extensive disagreements in various areas of science about different things, that the argument's kind of specious, that just because there are different explanations means that most of them are wrong. But
if we look back in the history of science, we can see everyone was wrong the way along.
Yeah, or
they have been wrong, and as science has evolved, you've refined understanding.
Yeah, and that's what he's celebrating about science, is that it continually refines his explanation. But also, many things are correct, but only in a limited sense. Like the example of Newtonian mechanics, just because relativity was discovered didn't mean all Newtonian mechanics was all of a sudden wrong. It was just that we discovered what the limits of it were. But let's just take his point of view that, okay, these religious teachings put forth these ideas. Well, if you stand his explanation on its head and say, okay, well, if there are commonalities, then they must be right. Well, I came across, I just tried to come up with my own list of commonalities in esoteric teachings, and I came up with one, the idea of hierarchy of self and consciousness at both the individual and the universal levels. Two, the idea of transformation, that the attainment of higher levels of consciousness and being is possible through psycho-spiritual transformation. Three, the idea of a substantive consciousness, that there are different gradations of consciousness in materiality and that there's a subtle anatomy and subtle dimensions. Four, that consciousness is light, metaphorically, physically, and metaphysically. Five, that consciousness is centered in the heart, both the physical and the spiritual heart. Six, that the realization of normal waking consciousness must be overcome in order to dispel the illusory reality in which we normally live. And seven, that the realization of the unity of all things occurs when consciousness is developed and fully realized within oneself. And that's just a list I jotted down, you know, in thinking about this. I mean, I'm sure
there are common elements within
common elements. I just saw another one, the sacred laws of 3 and 7 recur throughout esoteric teachings. So if we accept Sagan's premise that, you know, if we stand it on his head that just because there's so many different versions of things, they can't all be right. Well, if there are the same versions, then they must be right.
It's interesting. It's like the difference between esoteric and exoteric religion. On exoteric, the outer form of religions, they're all contradictory, different names, practices, beliefs, and so on. But it's in the esoteric, the hidden side of those religions, that they're the same. And that's what when Sagan's taking the exoteric side and seeing the differences in religions, and you're taking the esoteric side, which reveals the similarity within all the, like the heart doctrine is within all the religious traditions of the world, is this idea that self and God are realized through the awakening of the human heart. And that's in all the religious and mystical traditions. But people who just look at the exoteric side of religions don't realize that. Even people who grow up in different religions don't realize that's even taught in their own religions. Now, I've not met many Hindus who kind of realize even the idea of the series of the self within the heart, the Jiva Atma. They don't consider that, which is a core belief in Hinduism, they don't consider that as a possible scientific viewpoint. They compartmentalize it in their mind in a way, what is religion versus science. And that, what we're saying is that's a mistake. It's like the esoteric side of religions is science.
Yeah, it's the science of being and consciousness. And that's
yeah,
I say,
science of being and consciousness.
And
yeah.
As I said earlier when we talked about... When I said esotericism is the idea that probably is least understood by people, even educated and cultured people, to have no clue about it. And yeah. You know, it's the idea that there's this esoteric circle of humanity that has existed throughout the ages, and that ideas come from the esoteric circle, and then they go out into the exoteric, the outside circle of life, and they become disseminated, and then being disseminated, they become distorted, they become defiled, and they take on often meanings that are quite at odds with the original teachings. And that's why esoteric teachers talk about the unity of religious ideals, that in essence, all religions teach the same ideals and teach the same principles in their essence, in their core, in their esoteric nature. And as you say... these things, you know, aren't recognized. So, I mean, when you say esotericism, people don't understand it. Well, there isn't anybody who hasn't heard of an esoteric teacher. Jesus was an esoteric teacher. Moses was an esoteric teacher.
Yeah.
You know, Plato was an
Buddha,
esoteric
the Dalai Lama.
Buddha, you know, you can go through the. I mean, these are all figures in the history of esotericism. But it's funny, as you say, there's this disconnect between our normal understanding of things and the esoteric tradition. It's like it doesn't exist. It's hidden, but it's there, but it's hidden because people don't understand its purpose and its meaning.
Yeah, it's in the meaning. It was funny earlier when you quoted Sagan and saying, like, ours will be the generation where our kids will be taught the answers even before they've had the opportunity to ask the questions. And I thought, oh, that's a shame. That's what religion has done. Kind of religion has, in history, has kind of taught people the answers before they had time to ask the questions. So they end up, they're taught the answers. They've got this realm of conditioning and acquired information from outside.
And that's exactly what Carl Sagan is
and that's
reacting against, is this conditioned, you know, rigid thinking, which, as you say, doesn't allow, that's a very insightful comment, doesn't allow people to even formulate the questions. You know, you're taught, you know, as a Catholic or as a Jew or as a Muslim, you know, well, this is what Allah believes, this is what, you know, this is what God taught, you know, this is what Jesus said, you know, and this is what it means. Okay, game over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also mechanical and so lacking in consciousness.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, I have that Da Vinci Code is so popular at the moment. I'm not sure what I was trying to say about that, other than it's like people are so fascinated, oh, might there be like this hidden element to Christian teaching. In a way, that's what the movie's about, I'd say. They're trying to kind of find this hidden element and put together the Da Vinci Code to find this hidden element.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the movie's along that line, but it strikes me the study of mystical spiritual teachings is similarly trying to crack that Da Vinci Code. It is to take these clues that we glean from different mystical and metaphysical studies, and they're clues that have, like, profound, they're keys that, you know, unlock those inner doors of understanding. So we're trying to glean these keys from the mystical literature.
Yeah, well, you know, and along those lines, too, getting back to, like we said earlier, you know, Gurdjieff says, well, there's a religion of man, number one, man, number two, and man, number three, but we have no idea what the religion of man, number four, like a person whom consciousness is more properly developed, has a completely different understanding and a different religion from that of the three men of normal waking consciousness. And I was thinking, you know, there have been, I don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands of books written about the New Testament and about Jesus and about the scriptures. I guarantee you that anyone who is interested in the New Testament and who studies esoteric and mystical teachings and reads Maurice Nichols' The New Man will have a completely different understanding of the Gospels after reading that book. I remember when I read that book after studying The Fourth Way for several years, it just completely transformed my understanding of the Gospels, and I realized I'd read the Gospels and read them in sleep. I had no conception of what the esoteric meaning of the Gospels was.
Yeah, it's a whole other aspect that people aren't exposed to.
Yeah, and as Gurdjieff says, you know, he was often asked, well, if we are awake, if we are asleep, and our purpose here on earth is to awake, you know, why is this not mentioned in the Bible? And as he says, you know, it's throughout the Gospels, awake, watch, you know, it's there, but people don't understand it. They take it metaphorically when it's meant literally. You know, it's astounding when you have this perspective, how it changes everything.
Yeah, it's really quite wonderful to be more studied in esoteric traditions. It kind of transforms our ordinary understanding. Okay, so I was going to ask you, do you remember in my original writing, I wrote book one of The Problem of God's Contracting Universe at one point. It's no longer in existence or entitled such. Do you remember who I portrayed myself as?
Yes.
In the preface of that book.
Yes. Well, I was going to say that's when you were going to be Sherlock Holmes.
That's right, yeah.
In case number 1037.
That's right, yeah, because it was going to be an examination of the numbers of 10 and 3 and 7. And,
yeah,
and
a cosmic
and
sleuth.
Such.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're from the Sign of the Four by Sherlock Holmes, where he's saying to Watson, I want some problem to solve, something, you know, superhuman, mystery.
I didn't know that.
And then that was what I was proposing to do in that book series, was to try to tackle this mystery of the existence of God and the nature of human consciousness through my explorations of science and mysticism.
Well, it's interesting because when we were off air before, when we were just talking about what we might discuss today, we didn't really get into this because it's so complex. But you know, we were talking about the original formulation of the problem of God's contracting universe, and I sort of said to you, you know, something to the effect that you know, I thought you were nuts because you were going to undertake 7 volumes to discuss this question, and I thought, well, you know, that's just not right. I mean, I don't see how you can possibly do that. And now it's 27 years later, and even though you don't use the title The Problem of God's Contracting Universe anymore in any of your books, really it describes your entire corpus of work. It's your whole body of work is devoted to this question of the problem of God's contracting universe, and your volumes on the Heart Doctrine, the Within Without series, are really your formulation of your answer to this question of the problem of God's contracting universe, and it's an amazingly complex and at the same time inspiring body of work because it deals with essentially all and everything.
Yeah.
To use a Gurdjieff phrase, but it has applications on an individual and personal level, on a universal level, religion, science, ethics, morality, whatever. There isn't any area of discussion that you can go into that it doesn't have profound implications for.
Yeah, having a mystical perspective, yeah, just transforms your understanding of any subject we might explore, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the thrills we experienced early on, and even beginning with the Gurdjieff teaching, how absolutely thrilling it was, how we had so many revelations in just everyday experiences, so innumerable revelations and insights into things, and it kind of fills you with a sense of wonder and light and of being both physically light and being light-filled, like enlightened, and yeah, it was quite trippy.
It was quite awesome in the true sense of the word awesome, not just in the vernacular sense. And also, the other side of it is that I never really understood the idea of being in a state of grace, but looking back on perhaps the first 3 or 4 years of studying the Fourth Way and realizing the profound implications for this, I realized what it must feel like to be in the state of grace. It sort of felt like that. And afterwards, I felt, gee, you know, what an incredible period of time, you know, to have experienced that.
Yeah.
And yet, because it's a process, it always changes. I think that's one of that's what I was trying to get at when I was talking about, you know, 27 years later, you're still trying to answer the your question is about the problem of God's contracting universe. The process involves changes, and changes in your understanding, and changes in your perspective on everything. And yet, it's the process, it's the journey, which really makes it incredibly meaningful. I think it's a very special undertaking and very rewarding in its own peculiar way. It's hard to kind of I'm sort of talking around it, but it's hard to kind of convey a sense of the wonder of it all, but there is that wonder and that inspiration in realizing that, gee, you know, to just ask, to formulate these questions without accepting that the answers are in is truly a remarkable undertaking.
Yeah, even to know, to formulate what the questions are and understanding what that means and the nature of it,
yeah,
is profoundly important. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, I look back now, like after 30 years of studying in these areas, and it just shocks me over and over again how there's such a complete, almost complete absence of such perspectives in modern psychology, education, philosophy, in public awareness, in the media, and in culture. It's just like these ideas are so hidden.
Yeah, and not to sound like a broken
record. What it means to be esoteric.
That's a kind of the ultimate esoteric paradox, too, is that in a way, these ideas are not hidden whatsoever. They're there. I mean, they're there for anybody to explore. I mean, they're in all sorts of books, you know. There are all sorts of organizations which are involved in examining them and transmitting them, but at the same time, it's like they're invisible on a whole other level. They're completely invisible. Not to sound like a broken record, but I think in having spent 30 years studying these things, I think that's what I find most extraordinary, is how completely hidden they are in a sense, and how people don't see these things, you know. And
yeah.
So if in our small way, our little conversation here inspires a few people to explore them, I think it's quite worthwhile and maybe will have served some good.
Yeah. I think part of the problem, it's I like the story I told sometimes where I compare the Humpty Dumpty story. And Humpty Dumpty is like God, and he sat on a wall, and then he fell and smattered into a million pieces. And like God kind of falls into creation. And then we have all these pieces, and the king's trying to assemble Humpty Dumpty together again. And it's like he takes all his soldiers, and he divides them and has different groups of scientists, and they all begin studying the bits of Humpty Dumpty to put it together again. And all the scientists, in a way, become little bit scientists, Like, this is what I see the problem. Everyone becomes a specialist in some division of some specialty within a division of an area of science. So everyone has, in modern science, it's so technical in many ways, everybody has areas of expertise just on some fragment of the whole thing. And that every so much, we're all the scientists are little bit scientists. And no one in a way considers the relationship of their little bit to the whole. And that's what Swami Prabhupada emphasized in that you were referring to him earlier. He says, like, you scientists, you know, you take the grass and you can study the grass and you can write books and books and books about it. But of what use is it? The grass still grows. It's still there. He says, you need to understand the grass in terms of it being a manifestation of the mind or intelligence of God. And he said, look at the grass in this way. Every little phenomena of life ultimately is interrelated to the whole and as a manifestation of higher intelligence. So we need to look at life like this. And the whole thrust of modern science towards specialties and subdivisions has been towards little bit science. And thus, you know, everybody, it's just like why scientists don't want to address the issues of parapsychology, because that's not their area of expertise, and they're not really competent to speak about it. You know, and they recognize it. So everyone has their specialty, and they just avoid the broader issues of the meaning of the science and the relationship of the bit to the whole. But I see that as part of the problem here, the problem of God's contracting universe, is that to understand the unity of life, we have to understand anything in relationship to the whole. And that's kind of unique to the mystical perspective. Anything has to be understood in relationship to the whole. Okay, so I guess we're kind of coming up to 5 to 6. Well, thanks, Jim, for taking part today. And I did you have any final comments or thoughts you wanted to add, or?
No, I you know, thanks for having me, and enjoyed speaking with you on this, and I think that we've just sort of scratched the surface in terms of the problem. There's so many different angles as we've been speaking, you know, like almost everything you say triggers another thought and an association as to something that we might address in further talks, but I think, you know, we've sort of laid out the basic problem and your perspective on the mystical esoteric reply to Carl Sagan, and you know, I think there's more room to explore, and hopefully we can do it again on further broadcasts.
Yeah, I wonder. I thought maybe in 2 weeks from now, maybe we could take part and kind of continue some of this theme of the problem of God's contracting universe, but we'll look then at models of creation of the universe. Mm. And I didn't get to Blavatsky's secret doctrine this time, but I thought maybe next in 2 weeks' time, I'll begin with a study of the Blavatsky's secret doctrine, the cosmogenesis and metaphysics of the secret doctrine in the light of modern science. And then maybe you can come in for the second half of the show, and why don't we continue to explore this, you know, the issues of God and science and religion, and we can kind of look at some of Blavatsky's work compared with modern physics, and using that as at the focus of our same discussions.
Yeah, I'd love to. Sounds great.
Great, okay. Well, thanks again, and I'll let you go and probably end up. I think I've got a couple minutes. I'll have a few final announcements, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Bye. Thanks, James. Bye. Okay. Well, I never do stick to my schedule exactly. didn't get to Blavatsky today, but I will pick up on that and start with that in the next show. The next show is on June 14th at the same time. And I'll remind listeners that the shows are archived and made available within a few weeks after the show. And if you have any comments on the show, you can email me at Christopher Holmes, all small case letters, at rogers.com. And I do invite you to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. And I have quite a variety of my material up there. And I'd recommend people get a copy of The Heart Doctrine or Microcosm, Macrocosm. These are really two very profound books, and with so much substance in it. It's the kind of books that you keep with you and read and learn from through the years. They're a profound compendium of mystical knowledge and relating it to modern science. Okay, so I'd like to thank Don and Doug and BBS Radio for another show, and I don't know if someone will be cutting in here in a few moments, and I'm looking out on the river, a rainy day here in Ottawa.
Well,
I've
thank
been
you.
Enjoying
We're here, yeah, we're a little past, loved your show, thank you.
Great.
And we will see you next week, fantastic.
Yeah, 2 weeks' time.
You got, 2 weeks, correct.
Yeah, great.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thanks again, eh?
Okay.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.